Okay, so today we're going to talk about contracting methods and then alternate project delivery methods. So how you put contracts together, what contracts you use, why you make a decision on which contract. There are all different forms, you know, as I was just talking about. There's obviously the AIA forms. You can make your own forms. A lot of forms that are created, people use the AIA forms because they don't want to deal with the software. So they'll take provisions and they'll put it in their own form. And so they're like, oh, here's my company's contract. And then you start reading through it and you're like, well, that's AIA. And they've gotten around some of the copyright issues of AIA, but by and large, they're using those terms. So which type of form you want to use, we'll talk a little about that today, why you want to use that. And then the concept of alternate project delivery methods is what the traditional contract is. The architect design, or the traditional project delivery method of how a project gets from beginning to end. That's a project delivery method. Traditional is the architect gets hired and they do the design. It's very linear. Then they take those drawings and they go out to bid and they choose a contractor and then the contractor builds. That's called design, bid, build. That's a linear process. There are many other processes. There's design build, which is all in one. There's fast track, different types of fast tracks. There's alternate projects. So we'll talk about that. But I would say, in this day and age, because people have learned to understand it, you know, when I first started teaching this class, design build was used quite a bit, but it was not used nearly as much as it is used now. I think many projects now will have some fast track element to it, where there's an overlap of the design and the construction portion, and we'll see what that looks like, because contractors and architects have become more sophisticated. But I still believe that the majority of projects that are out in the country, are in the U.S., are design, bid, build. But you want to know about how different methodologies work, so we'll talk about that. So, okay, so let's first talk. Obviously, we went through the B101 the last 2 weeks. Let's talk about how they're structured. I've mentioned this before. So we have the A series, and the A series are all owner and contractor documents. So anything, if you're on an AIA, it'll say AIA 2017, A, and this says 201. There's a 100 series, there's the 700 series, so there's all different A forms. So anytime you see an AIA document that has an A before a three-digit number, that is dealing with the contractor. B series are the owner architects. So anytime you see an AIA document that starts before the three-digit number with a B, you know that is an owner architect agreement. And think of it this way too: the A and B are at the top of the tree, I guess is what you want to say. So you've probably seen me use like the hand gestures. At the top of, think of it as a triangle. At the top of the triangle always is the owner. And then you come down to the two legs of the triangle and you have the architect on one side of the bottom corner of the triangle, and you have the contractor on the other side. There is a solid line between those two. In that triangle, the solid line means a contract. There are legal obligations between those two. So the A series documents and the B series documents are going to be that solid line of the main triangle. Below that, the architect's going to have its consultants, the mechanical engineer, the civil engineer, whoever they're going to hire. And on the contractor side, below that other corner of the triangle, there's going to be subcontractor agreements. Those are going to be different letters. And so those are going to be the C series. Now, they do not split in the C series between, it's not like C is architects and D is contractors. Any C series is going to be the second tier down. So you may have a C-series document that only architects use or only contractors use. So that's further down in this triangle. So the triangle comes down and then it kind of goes straight down and you have all these C-series documents. So they're going to deal with subcontractors. And the other way you want to think about it too is on the construction side, the contractor side, they're traditionally called subcontractors, below the contractors. On the design side, they're traditionally called consultants, or sub-consultants. You normally do not see, and I would strongly recommend not to have a subcontractor under an architect. And I'll give you an example right now of a case that I was dealing with without telling anybody about it. I had a case where the owner entered into the traditional triangle. The architect designed, they went out to bid, and they went to build. So it's your traditional triangle. And when they bid the project, the owner entered into a contract with the contractor. So that was one of the A-series documents on the other side. They had already executed a B-series document with the architect. Traditional triangles were looking at it. But the architect came to the owner and they said, "Hey, we can save you some money. We have good relationships with people in the industry. We've been doing this for years. We can get you some contracts where we will supply materials, construction materials, doors, windows, floors, tile work, stuff that the contractor would normally build and normally purchase. We can get that for you because we have these relationships, and we can get that for you at a discounted price, and then we will charge a markup, just like any markup, because we're handling it for you, and we'll handle that for you." And the contractor was in agreement with that, so it's basically taking things out of the scope. So the contractor didn't have to buy any doors or windows for this project. This was a big project. It was about, the doors and windows contract was over $1 million, just for doors and windows. So it was a big project. So the contractor didn't purchase any of those doors and windows. When the doors and windows arrived, the architect on the side that entered into the agreement on the other side, because they purchased the doors and windows, they got the markup, they got the additional fee, and told the owner, "Hey, we're going to make money, we're going to save you money off of this." Of course, the architect was making money because they got their markup, so the architect's making money, and they arrived to the site. The contractor installed the doors and windows because they have the carpenters that put the doors and windows in. But if there was a defective door or window, contractor says, "It's not my problem. I didn't supply it. I just put it into the building." Well, shockingly, the doors and windows leak. So now you get to a situation where the architect is acting like a contractor because they're supplying construction materials. And in certain instances, not only did the architect supply materials in this case, but they actually also hired people to supply and install, like floors, like your hardwood floors or your tile floors. They actually had their own people installing them. And so what ended up happening with this project is there was problems with it. Doors and windows leaks. The floors were warped. They didn't fit, lots and lots of problems. And so now you have to figure out who is responsible. And the architect's like, "I'm just an architect, I don't do this." But you did, you got a markup for it, you charged the owner for it, and when you dropped off your doors and windows to the project site, the contractor didn't care, because he wasn't responsible. Contractor didn't buy these doors and windows, they put them up if they leaked, so whose fault is it? Is it the contractor's installation? Should the contractor have known that these doors were defective? Did the contractor do something to change what was delivered to the site? Or should the architect be responsible? And that's a big mess. So in both instances, the supplier of materials as opposed to services would be a subcontractor. When you hire a civil engineer, all they're going to do is draw and design for you. Those are services. If you remember last week, when we went through the B101, the term with the capitalized letter was services. Basic services, additional services, supplemental services. So you want to think for yourselves, architects provide services, which are designs and drawings. Contractors provide work, with a capital W. That's labor and materials. And so one of the biggest problems with this case is the architect, even though they said they were saving the client money, wanted to get into the world where they can make more money off of these materials and some of the installation, and then they didn't do their job because they're not a general contractor. So this is kind of more of a lessons learned than anything else. When you do your triangle, when you are on the C-series documents, you're looking at C-series documents, the architect should only use the ones that talk about consultants. If you start doing subcontractors, you become a general contractor, you assume all these risks about safety and all these other things that you want to be involved in. So subcontractors should stay on the contractor side, consultants stay on the consultant, on the design side. Okay? The thing over here, construction manager, we're going to talk a little bit about that. Sometimes an owner will hire a third party outside of the triangle. And that's a construction manager, and that's somebody that only is there to protect the owner. They're going to kind of back-check the architect and back-check the contractor, and they're going to be an owner entity that's going to be there to protect the owner. The AIA lumps them into the C-Series as well. So, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the last one down here that I have here, G-Series, these are payment documentations. What does your bill look like, your invoice? It literally is how you put together an invoice as the G-Series. G-702 and some other ones, 703. Those are more like fill-in-the-blanks once a month, so when you get an invoice, you'll see it. It looks like it's got a very specific form, what work was being performed, and everything else. Okay. Now, as I said, in the A series, there are... do you need a plug? The A series has two different sides. So when we get to the B series, there are only the B100s, and I'll have a slide coming up on that. With the A series, there's an A100 set and then an A200 set. They work together. And what you want to think about is the A100 series are the business terms. What are the dollars? Who are the parties? What are the dollars? And what's the timing? So those are the business terms that will go into the A100 series. And the A200 series are what's called the general conditions, the general terms and conditions. It's what are the parties' obligations of how they actually do the construction. So it's the actual work that's being performed and described that's going to be of how the work is performed. That's in the 200 series. The A100 series, for most intents and purposes, is just the business terms. What are the dates we begin? Who are the parties? What's the description? Remember when we did the initial information last week on the B101? There's an initial information part in the A100 series. What's the price? What are the dates of delivery? Those types of things. That's in the A100 series. Okay? Now, there are three main types of models that you're going to use. They're payment models and bidding models. That's the 101, the 102, and the 103. Those are what are traditionally used, not just in the AIA documents, for basically all construction projects. The first one, the A101, is based on what's called a stipulated sum or a lump sum. I've used this example a bunch of times. I'm going to build your house. I'm the contractor. I will build your house for $600,000. Whatever those drawings are, I look at them. I can build that for $600,000. That's a lump sum for one price. I'm going to tell you what that is. It's agreed to. The parties do it. It's not based on how much materials I use have to buy. It's not based on how much labor. I mean, I calculate that $600,000 based on my knowledge of the industry. But the owner says, if my drawings don't change and you build exactly what my architect provided, all I have to pay you is $600,000 lump sum or stipulated sum. That's the 101. That is by far the most common construction contract used in the country. A lot of people don't want to deal with the headaches. They don't want to have to deal with all the backup invoices, and they don't want to have to watch. They just do it by a lump sum. And how do you know what to pay? Well, what happens is if I'm doing a $600,000 project and it's going to take me 6 months, at the end of 1 month, I come to you and I say, I've done, and it may not be this equal, I've done 1/6 of the work, so you owe me 100 grand. Or maybe it's 1/5, you owe me a little bit more. It's called, you pay them by a percent complete. So the architect walks around the site and kind of says, yeah, it looks like they're 20% done. You can pay them 20% of the $600,000. So that's how you get paid on a lump sum. You get paid on what's called a percent complete basis. That's the A101. The A102 is a form of agreement based on the cost of the work. Remember we talked about cost of work last week, what it is, plus a fee with a guaranteed maximum price. So let me break down each one of those. If you remember from last week, the cost of the work defined in 6.1 of the B101, it's the actual cost of the construction, materials, labor, if there's permits, general conditions, whatever the contractor gets a bill from a subcontractor, that's the cost of work. The contractor has a project manager on the site for 4 hours. They bill at a certain rate, $100 an hour, so that $400 is a cost of the work. The contractor has to rent a trailer. Trailer sits in the lot. They pay $1,725 every month for that trailer. That is a cost of the work. So what happens in this form, the A102, it's very transparent. every single dollar the contractor has to pay or expend, whether it's labor, materials, equipment, rentals, those types of things, every single dollar is denoted as the cost of the work. And when you get that monthly invoice from the contractor, it's got the cover sheet that says you owe me $250,000, and then there's every single invoice behind it, every single document. So I was going through invoices yesterday for one of my contractors, and they were like 95 pages long because it was a $400,000 invoice, and it was like 95 pages because it literally had photocopies of when they had to run to Home Depot to buy more nails because they didn't have enough from that were showed up. So that's the cost of the work, the actual transparent cost of the work, plus a fee. The contractor has to make money. If they are only transferring the dollar for dollar, they wouldn't make any money. So they charge the owner a fee on top of it. So if I have a 10% fee and I get a $100 invoice in from Home Depot when we had to buy $100 worth of nails, I'm going to charge the owner $110. I do a 10% markup on every single dime and dollar and penny of the cost of the work. And that fee is negotiated. So just to give you some examples in the city of Chicago. In the city of Chicago, if you're going to be doing like an office renovation, so you work for a company, they want to put in some conference rooms or anything, you're going to see the fee that the contractor is going to charge anywhere between 1.5% and 3%, somewhere in that, that's on top of every dollar they spent. When you get to commercial work, like we're going to build a strip mall or we're going to build something else, you're going to see the fees are going to range anywhere between 4% and 7%, somewhere in there. And we're going to do this next week, or a couple weeks when we do the economic construction. I'm going to show you more. When you get into residential, you may see anywhere between 6% and 14%, depending on the level of sophistication and everything else. So the percentage of the fee, of that fee that's based on a percentage, is negotiated for each project, from project to project. But it's charged on top of the cost of the work. Now, there's other variations of it. Sometimes you just get actually a standard fee. It's not a percentage. We won't get into all the details. But normally what happens is the fee is a percentage tacked on the cost of the work. And then the last part of this contract, so it's got three different ways that the economics work on it. The last one is called with a guaranteed maximum price. What does that mean? When we know on the stipulated sum, the lump sum, that house is never going to, if nothing changes, that house is never going to cost the owner more than $600,000. So that's a guaranteed price. I guarantee you 600 grand if no changes happen. Owners like that because, especially like if you're in the business world, you can go back to your board of directors or you can set budgets and you know you're never going to spend more than that $600,000. Maybe it's $1.2 million or maybe it's $200 million, whatever it is that the stipulated sum is. You like to have that assurance of what that number is. But at the same time, you're like, wait a minute, I got this $100 million project. How do I know the contractor's not putting fluff in there? How do I know that they're not just scamming me with these invoices and everything else? If it's a $600,000 house is one thing, but I got a $100 million project, how do I know that they're not building in like outrageous profit that I don't see because I'm not seeing all the backups? So when you get into this, that's when you get the A101, you don't see any backup. You just see the bill for what the value of the work is that month. This one, as I said, is very transparent. So this is very nice for the owner because they get to see every dime being spent on the project. But they like the benefit of the end, the stipulated end date, end number. So we have this guaranteed maximum price, or sometimes called a GMP contract. And what happens with a GMP contract is the contractor comes in and says, I'm going to charge you for the cost of the work plus my fee, but I will never go over $100 million as long as your project doesn't change. That's the cap, the guaranteed maximum price. And then it's up to the contractor to try to beat that price to keep the owner happy. Because if it goes over the $100 million, the contractor has to pay for it because he said, I guarantee you never more than $100 million. If it stays under, the owner's happy and maybe he gets repeat business. And sometimes you build in incentives. Like if you come in at $95 million, you save me $5 million, we'll share that difference. I'll give you for free 10% of that or 20% of that. And so maybe the contractor comes in $5 million under and he's got a $20 million or he's got a 20% savings clause. Contractor just gets $1 million for free that he never spent. So there's some incentives you can do for that. But the point of the A102 is to get the owner the assurance that there's a cap never going to go over it. That's the guaranteed maximum price. but to get the benefit of seeing every single invoice. So it's transparency plus a guarantee, which takes that guarantee from the A101. Does that make sense? Last type of form, the A103. This is agreement based on the cost of work plus a fee, so that whole transparency thing, without any guarantee. There's no cap whatsoever. It can go, it'll cost whatever it'll cost. And you're like, oh my God, why would any owner ever want to enter into a contract where there is no end date and no end dollar in sight, no cap? Most of them don't, but sometimes you have a project where that's the only way you're going to get the contractor to do the work. If you do any remodeling work, if you do any renovation work, if you do any historical work where you go into a building, no one knows what's behind the walls. So a contractor can't and will not bid a guaranteed price. They're going to be like, if I guarantee it and I open it up and it's all rotting and falling apart, for God's sake, that's going to cost me hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars to fix it. If the plumbing is falling apart, the electrical, I don't know, I don't have x-ray vision. So if you want me to remodel your house, or you want me to do this historical renovation, some of these projects, they say, the only way you're getting me is if I just do it at the cost of the work, and whatever it costs you, it costs you. Another area where you're going to get only the cost of the work without any type of cap, specialty services. I'm the only person in a 1,000-mile radius that can do this work. I got the leverage. You want me to do this? I'm going to charge you that. I had a client for many years, but they were a really nice group of people that I worked with. They had they started in the oil and gas industry, and they were very sophisticated in the connections for the piping when you had oil wells and everything else. And then they did a specialty service where they went in and they actually had deep divers. So for these wells that were drilled like the riggers and everything that are out in the oceans and stuff. So they had these people that would go down in these mini subs, or they would go down and they would actually do underwater rigging of these pipes and tubes and everything. Highly, highly specialized. And then they got into this area that they had the specialized how they tap it. And they got into this area of also working in the water industry. And so I did some contracts with them. Actually, we did a contract where the water was moving through off in New York City. And the size of these giant pipes that the water would come through, they were like, I think they were 12 feet in diameter of the amount of water that was coming in from the Hudson River. And one of the facilities where they had to change out this pipe. And you can imagine, this is not a project that you can take months and months and months. You don't shut down the city of New York and their water supply instantaneously, or you know, for months and months. People have to get water. So these are projects that take place over a matter of days. And there was one project where the water pipes were under a building in downtown Manhattan, 11 floors underground. Nobody even knew that they were there. And so we had all these logistics of where these pipes had come in, the city and everything else, and how they got down there, blah, blah, blah. That's the type of form they use. They had their own contracts that used the AAA. But they said, it's going to cost you what it's going to cost you. I am not going to give you a cap. I am not, whatever it costs, the actual materials and whatever hours I have to do. But we're the only people, and literally at the time, they were the only people in the Western Hemisphere that could do the work. So that's what they did. And that's the type of form they use, is they'll use a cost. So sometimes if you're so specialized, you can say, I'm just going to charge you what's going to charge you. I'm not going to give you a guaranteed price. So those are the three main. And again, these are the AAA forms, but everybody's going to use those, even if you don't have a standard form. It's going to be lump sum, it's going to be a GMP, or it's just going to be cost of the work. Those are the types you're going to see. Any questions on that? Now, why are there two more forms out here? So this one here, the A104, the A104 is actually kind of for a smaller project. Remember I told you that most of the AAA documents you're going to have two. You're going to have an A100 form, and it's going to be linked together with an A200 form, which we'll show in a second. The A200 form has, and we'll talk about that also in the second half of the semester, the A200 form has all the, that was called the rules of monopoly, how you're going to build. The AA recognized, because it's like a 50-page document, it's 10-point font, it's tiny. The AA recognized, it's like, oh my God, people don't want this massive document. You got a 20-page document in the front end, you got a 50-page document, 70 pages, and they just want to put on a, like we did at my house, a 100-square-foot addition on the back of the house. You don't need a 75-page document. So they came up with this A104, which takes these three formats and combines them, and then it takes the A200 and combines it. So this is like a one-stop shop. If you get A104, it's got all the important stuff from the A200 series, and then it's got a check the box. It says in the beginning, the payment for this project will either be stipulated sum, GMP, or cost plus. Cross the other ones out and choose the one you want. So this is the kind of like all-in-one. So when you do a small project, and a small project can be even in the millions, but it's not, it doesn't require a lot of this stuff. So like, I have a project going on right now that is, we're using an A104, and it's adopting the A103 series concept. It's a cost plus because it's a renovation. So we said, I can't give you cap. So we crossed out these two portions of it in the A104. And then it's got all the terms and conditions from the A200 series in the back end. So that's what it's for. It's like the one-stop kind of a... And that it's called, it's literally called standard abbreviated form. And the last one I have up here is the A141. The A141 is the design build form that they use in the AIA. And that's when a contractor and architect get together and they both do design and construction. And we'll get a little bit more into that of how that structure works. But they have a form for that. There are bazillions of others. Like the AIA probably has, if you ever go to their website, there's hundreds of forms. But these are the main ones you're going to see in your career. You're going to see the 101, the 102, 103, 104, and then 141. And then actually probably, just because it's the AIA and everything else, maybe by to the 2027s when they come out, they may change all the letters. Like the A104 used to be the 107, and the 141 used to be something else. And so sometimes they change the numbers, but the concepts are the same. Any questions on those? Okay. B-Series. This one I have a little graphic so you can understand. So the B, they have the 101, which we talked about here. And then there's the 103, the 104, and the 105. I don't even know if there's a 102 out there. There may be. I've never used it. I've never seen it. I can't remember. So there may be. I just honestly don't know. But these are the ones you're going to see. So the way I put this graph together is on the top of this, it says large project, big, giant project. So my $300 million project in Nashville would be 103 because it's got so many things going on. Small projects down here, my renovation of my addition to my house. We actually use a B104, but you can use the 105 too. It's very simple, very simplistic about what the architect's responsibilities are. Again, B-Series because it's own architect. But you can see the B101 spans all of those. It can go from small to large. 90% of the contracts you guys are going to use if you're using the AIA is going to be B101. It covers everything. My $300 million project in Nashville could be a B101. The owner just likes the 103 because it's got a few more tweaks that they can have with the architect. My project that we did in my house could have been a B101. It can go, it covers everything. And then the 104 is that small one, and the reason why, like I said, sometimes AA changes it. Remember I said there was the A107, it's now called the A104? Well, the reason why they changed the number is because there was already a B104 for the same type of smaller project. So they said, people would get confused. Why do I have a B104 and not an A104? So they just changed the number. So when you're using B104, it makes sense to use the A104 with the contractor. So these are your sizes and your scopes of the B-series documents. By and large, concepts in these B-series documents are going to be the same as what we talked for the last 2 weeks in the B101. Some will have a few more terms, some will have less, but the owner's obligations and the architect's obligations are generally the same in each one. They just kind of shrink them down or beef them up a little bit. That's it for the kind of structure of the forms, all right? Now, we'll go through pricing variations in construction contracts. And I talked a little bit about this. Why do we do this? So I'm going to go through some more detail of lump sum, fixed price, stipulated sum, why we do the time and materials and cost of work, the 102. We'll kind of explain that a little bit more. So with the 101 or any stipulated sum or lump sum contract, if it goes over the $600,000, contractor bears all that risk. That's the bonus for the owner and the risk for the contractor. They pay all cost overruns. The bonus for the contractor, you're like, well, why would any contractor enter into that if all of a sudden it's going to be too much? The bonus for it is if the contractor says, I can do it for $600,000, and the owner agrees, and the contractor comes in for its own actual cost at $500,000, it's already made a $100,000 profit. And that contractor doesn't have to explain it to the owner, doesn't have to tell the owner. They just said, I will do it for $600,000. You don't get to look at my books. And that's where this owner says, oh, wow, maybe you're not being honest with me. So that's where there's risks and there's rewards for the contractor side, and it works the same way with the owner. But what happens to that? Because there's a curtain behind the contractor's billing, it can create an adversary relationship between owner and contractor. The contractor, let's say, like I had a project where I've had a number of these projects where the contractor comes in and bids a lump sum. Many, by the way, many government projects, the majority of government projects are bid on lump sum basis. They're not often bid on cost of the work or GMP. There are some statutes that can allow that and everything else, but many construction contracts are lump sum, or governmental construction contracts are lump sum basis. So sometimes what happens, whether it's private or governmental, a contractor will low bid it. Let's say it's a project that's worth, the architect has been telling you along that you're a private company, we're going to be building this toy factory, and the architect tells you that this is a $50 million toy factory, and they've been, your budget is $50 million, their estimates are coming in between 48, 49, 50, right around that area, and you all know that. And you get a bid in, and it's $42 million. And sit there at this lump sum of 42. You got these two or three other contractors that are around 50. Maybe even a couple that are like 52 and 53. And you got this $42 million one sitting out there, and you're like, whew, that sounds really enticing. I mean, it's $8 to $10 million less than everybody else. Now, you should scratch your head and really kind of do some homework to see why there's such that big difference. That's actually 20% on a $50 million project if there's a $10 million swing. But maybe you go with that contractor. And then what ends up happening is the contractor starts submitting change orders and says, oh, the drawings weren't really clear here, so I need more money on this. Or this happened. And all of a sudden, I had one project that they came in, they bid it at $75 million. It was $9 million less than the nearest bid. There were four bidders. Went to the board of directors. I was not part of any of this part, by the way. I got brought in after the fact. The bids went to the board of the directors. And the board of directors, I don't know if it was the chairman, somebody on the board of directors, I wasn't there, but I was told this by their in-house counsel, said $9 million, we should go with them, and the council was like, you know, we should probably look into this a little bit more, they may be concerned. And the board of directors, one of them, the guy, gentleman or woman, whoever said, $9 million will buy a lot of aspirin. This project cost them like $18 million more than the original $75 million bid. Not only was it $9 million not put there, but there were so many goof-ups and screw-ups and everything else, there was another $9 million on top of that. So they didn't come in $9 million under anybody else, they came in $18 million over theirs, and had they gone with another contractor, they would have saved. So it didn't buy them a lot of aspirin. It bought them a lot of headaches. It bought them a lot of legal fees. So there's this adversary relationship because sometimes contractors will use the lump sum bid to come in lower. Now, I'm not trying to say that all contractors do this. There's a lot of, most contractors are honest and they do their best and everything else. But there are pitfalls because you can't see the books. You don't get to see what's behind the scenes. And that's where, well, this last one here, the change orders. There are going to be change orders in every project. Because no architect's drawings are 100% right. Weather happens, soils, whatever happens. So there's always going to be a change order on a project. But some contractors may take advantage of that. Some contractors may be fine. But I did say, if you remember, the majority of your projects are still going to be bid on a lump sum because it's just easier all the way around. You just have to be more careful when you look into it. So what are the benefits, risks, and rewards for doing a cost of the work, whether it's with a guaranteed maximum price, that cap, or just an open-ended? First of all, we talked about the fee can be a percentage. That's your normal one. It's a 10%, it's 5% on the cost of the work. It can be a fixed sum. I had a house, a high-end residential house out in California. It was about a $26 million home. And the owner said, the contractor said, we're not going to charge you a percent on the cost of the work. We're just going to charge you this amount every week. Doesn't matter. So no matter what, every single week we're going to charge you these dollars for our fee. And whether they spent that money or not, sometimes they may internally spend more, sometimes they did less, so it was a fixed weekly fee regardless. Networks actually benefit for them because if the project goes longer, they keep getting that fixed weekly fee and they can make a lot more money. But that's the way it was negotiated. So they didn't want to do a percentage on the cost of the work, they did a fixed fee. I've seen them both. I've seen a combination. We'll do a percentage, and after we get to a certain amount, we're going to start charging fixed. So you can kind of, this is, the fee is always negotiated. And the fee is the owner, is the contractor's profit, and other stuff are mixed into it. There may be a cap. We've talked a little bit about that already, that why the GMP has a cap, why you do that, because it kind of combines the lump sum with the open transparency of it. It can be difficult for the owner to control costs. If you're using the 103, it's open-ended. If you're using the 102, that's the GMP that allows the owner to say, we're never going to go over the $100 million GMP or the $75 million GMP or whatever it might be. There may be the savings clause. I kind of briefly described that, but I'll go over it again just so you understand it. On a guaranteed maximum price contract, a GMP contract, I'm going to provide you, I guarantee you, no matter what, your project will never be over $100 million. And I was like, perfect. I like that. But the contractor, if they can make money off of it, why wouldn't they spend $999,999,999? Why wouldn't they go all the way up to the $100 million? Because they can make the most money off of that, because everything they get charged, that percentage of the cost of work. So the owner wants to do something to incentivize that contractor to come in under the $100 million. How do you do that? You say to the contractor, for every dollar you come in under $100 million, we will split, we will share that savings, because you're saving me money. So let's do a 80-20 split. Let's do a 75-25 split, where 80% of that, 80 cents on that every dollar, I keep as my profit. Money I didn't spend. But I will give you 20%. So that $100 million concept with a 20% shared savings, and you're going to see that the industry kind of holds it around 75-25, 80-20. That's a very common shared savings fee that's out there, amount that's out there. And you're going to see that that $100 million project, if I came in at $95 million, I've saved you $5 million. I get to keep 20% of that, so you just, at the end of the project, I give you my last invoice and said, here's my $95 million, and you write me another check for $1 million in that. And that's pure profit for the contractor. It's a great way to have a good relationship between the owner and the contractor, too, because they're both working for the same goal. The contractor's working for literally how efficient can he or she be to get free money. And the owner is wanting that contractor to be as efficient as they can be to save the owner money. So it's a really good relationship. And most big projects that I work on are the GMP contracts. It's just the best relationship that I find. Change orders. For the cost of the work, the contractor pays for the work performed. So this gets a little bit more confusing. And the best way I can describe it is, so we have this $100 million project, and the contractor comes in and says, I need a change order because the soils were bad. We have to bring in geotech matting, we have to put in different sand, whatever the issue is for the soils so things don't have problems. We believe that that's going to be $1 million. So I want a change order for $1 million to my contract. So the guaranteed maximum price goes from $100 million to $101 million. Okay? So any dollar under $101 million now, the contractor gets savings. They haven't performed the work. They believe it's going to cost $1 million to do, so the change order is for $1 million. Contractor brings in the excavator, they put in the geotech mat, they put in the sand, whatever they need to do to shore up the soils, and it costs the contractor $850,000. The contractor only charges the owner the $850,000 plus its fee. The contractor does not actually charge $1 million, but the GMP still stays as $101 million. And there's that, between the $850,000 and the million change order, that's $150,000 the contractor saved, and they get 20% of that. So there's these incentive things that built into even change orders. So in the concept of a change order with a GMP or any change order, you only pay for the cost of the actual work performed. That's the way it's negotiated. Okay? That math is not going to be on the exam. I just wanted to give you to understand it. You don't have to worry about that. But I'm not going to have an example where, like, okay, here's a change order. How much does the contractor say? Well, don't worry about that. And that's what this last part here is it only changes the GMP. So the contractor gets this, you know, and you want to make sure the contractor is also being honest. That's why you may have an outside owner's rep. Oh my God, you told me this change order is going to be $1 million? I think the work that you're actually going to perform is only $500,000. Let's get the realistic. So, because you don't want a contractor taking advantage of bumping up the GMP, especially if there's a savings clause. Because the more money that GMP goes up and the lower the contractor comes under it, the more money the contractor gets for the savings. So there's some negotiation that goes on in that last point, and you want to have kind of checks and balances. Any questions on that? Unit prices. Last way of pricing a project. Unit prices are often used when there are multiple, literally, units. Brick walls, when you come in and you put up a brick wall, how many bricks are you going to use? Or when you're putting in, like we see all around, it's like all this ductwork. It's based on a linear foot or any of the electrical conduit or plumbing. A lot of that is based on linear feet. And so instead of bidding a project where it says, I'm going to do all your plumbing work for $275,000, what it says is, I'm going to do all your plumbing work and the copper is going to be at $35 a linear feet or whatever the price is. And the PVC is going to be at 8 cents of, I don't even know what the prices are, so I don't even go in. But it will be based on literally a linear foot or a actual unit. Actual piece of the material. So that's a unit price. And so sometimes, you're just paying for the cost of the work, but it's literally, how many bricks do I do? How many cubic yards of concrete am I pouring? How many linear feet of tubing or what have you? So that's a unit price often built into construction contracts. So those are your pricing. Any questions on that? Okay. Competitive bidding. Remember we had these, if you remember back into the B101, phase four was a bidding process, and we talked about just the beginning of today's class, design, bid, build. So there's this bidding process. Once the designs are ready, how do we get contractors in to get the best party, the best entity? So, competitive bidding, it is required for all public projects. The concept behind that is, any governmental project is spending the public's money. So we as the government have to make sure we're being careful with the public, so we must bid it. We can't just ask our friends to do that. And there have been many, many scandals throughout every state in the union where they're just handing it off to their buddies and maybe it wasn't accurately or properly bid or what have you. But every single state and every single municipality, that the governmental thing has a procurement statute that lays out how the bidding process needs to go and they must be competitively bid. You can use a competitive bid process for private projects. We do that all the time. You come in, you have the drawings done, you send it out for bid, and it's competitively bid. And in private, you can competitively bid for GMP or lump sum. Most of the time in government, it's going to be lump sum. So, what are the terms that they look for as to who wins the bid? They must be the lowest responsible and responsive bidder. What is lowest responsible and responsive? It used to be just low bid wins, but you find out that low bid might not be the party that does the work, may not be sufficiently skilled, may not have the proper experience, or maybe when they filled out the forms, they didn't actually fill in all the blanks, and so while it came in at $50 million, they forgot to fill something in, or they didn't fill it in accurately, it should have been $52 million, so it needs to be responsible that they can do the work and properly responsive to what's being requested. They've actually filled it out properly. They know what the work is. So you have to, number one, on a competitive bid, certainly for governmental, lowest responsible and responsive bid. Another one that you can use, not normally done in the construction project, but it is a competitive bidding process, is called best value. Best value does not have to be the lowest. Often it's used in design build, but it can be for contractor, for general contracting and everything else. And what happens is you have this kind of more flexible analysis. You look at it and you say, oh, I like their team. I like that they've worked on 17 of these similar projects. They feel like they have more experience than these other people that have only done two. So while I look at their price and their price is actually second lowest or maybe even third lowest out of five, they feel like they're bringing to me the best team, and it's the best value for my client, or for us, as for the client themselves. And so you can have this best value method in the private sector. It's traditionally not allowed in public jobs because that gets into the, I'm going to give it to my buddy. You know, because it brings in subjective analysis instead of objective. Now, there's matrices. One of the things I specialize is in procurement, so I build these matrices and I talk to my clients. I teach them actually how to try to take those subjective things and make them as objective as possible. If you guys ever saw one of my matrices for my large projects and how we did them, it would kind of make your mind think. I have columns and numbers and calculations and everything else, and all weighted scales are called KT analysis and everything else. So you can try to get some objectivity into this to get to the best value. But there have been, like I said, many governments across the country have been in problems. That's why they want this only lowest responsible bid, so you don't give this to your buddy. There can be exceptions for this lowest responsible and responsive or best value method that you can use in public projects, which is called sole source. That client I just talked to you about, where we worked out in Manhattan, we were doing the water change project, they were the only entity that could do it in the Western Hemisphere. They charged what they wanted, they bid what they wanted, nobody could do the work. We were sole source. So it was easy for them. They didn't have to bid. They just sent in a price. It had to go through a sole source process. A lot of these procurement statutes for the governmental entities say, if it's sole source, you have to do this and this and this and this. You have to go through the hoops to prove it, but then you don't have to bid against anybody else. So that's your competitive bidding process there. So the purpose of that is to achieve the lowest cost and impart a forum for the contractor selection, to give the owner, whether it's the government, whether it's me doing my backyard renovation, or whether it's a business or something else, is to understand what's the best and lowest cost that you would do. So that's that part here. How do you do the process? Well, you send out the drawings, and you say to, you can, and like in a government job, they'll post it on the website. Hey, we're building this building, and they post on the website so anybody in the world can do this if they want to bid on it. There's this whole unique process. I've done a couple of big projects up in Quebec, the province of Quebec. Man, this whole forum, it's very unique as well. It's called the BSDQ that you have to go through. And it's French, I don't remember what it means for, but they have this very specific process, and they have this matrices of certain types of trades have to bid certain ways, and it has to go on the website and different things, and they have to sign in, and everybody can bid. But there are very different ways. But once the bid's out, eventually you're going to get prices coming in. Contractors are going to submit their responses to what's called an RFP, Request for Proposals. The contractors will submit their proposals, and you're going to look at them all, you as the owner, you're going to be working with the owner, and you're going to look at them, you're going to look at price, you're going to look at experience, you're going to look at the team, you're going to look at their legal problems, you're going to look at any of those other stuff, and you're going to try to create a short list. You got 10 bids in, we want to bring it down to 3, or to 5, or to 2, whatever it is. So you're going to try to short list before and after the RFP process. Sometimes you even say, like I said, in Quebec, you have to almost bid it to everybody in the world or leave it open to everybody in the world. But like maybe for a project that you're doing for a private company, you may say, I've done my homework and I'm going to send my drawings only out to 5 contractors because they're the 5 we want to bid. So that's before the RFP. And when the 5 come back for the bid, you reduce it down to 2 or 3 or something. So that's before or after the RFP. So you have this pre-qualification and then after proposals are received. So like we had a project where we had this pre-qual process. They went out to 12 different contractors. I think 9 of the 12 submitted their pre-qualification forms. That was before they even saw the drawings. Here's, you know, there's a very kind of high level. Of those 9, the owner sat down and said, we don't want to work with 4 of them, and so they went out to the RFP to only 5. Of the 5, they got 3 bids, and then we tried to shortlist. We shortlisted to 2, and then we ended up with 1. So there's all different ways you can do this process. So, how does it work when you're going out to bid? You send out the invitation to the bidders. Sometimes it's broadcast on a website. Some you specifically say, I want you to bid. You give an invite to them. They submit their bids or proposals back to you as to the owner. Contractor says, here, I've read your drawings. I've looked at the program. I understand the project. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's my team and everything else. There's the opening of the bids and proposals. In that RFP, it's going to say, all bids are due no later than 5 p.m. March 15th, 2024. Anything that comes in after 501, not accepted. If it's a government, they're going to stand by that lockstep because, again, they don't want to have problems with the statute and everything else. If it's a private entity that comes in a little later, there's more flexibility because it's their own money. But normally you're going to have the set date, and then it's going to say, we're going to open these on March 16th or what have you at noon. If it's a governmental project, there's going to be a lot, it's not going to be uncommon that it'll be a public opening. Private doesn't have to do that. Then there's going to be the evaluation process. You're going to have a team that's put together that's going to do this analysis. If I'm hired, I'm going to show them how to do the analysis. But a lot of times, it's just people sitting around. They don't hire a lawyer. They don't hire a procurement person. They're going to sit down with their architect, and they're going to be like, hey, Sarah, we got in these five bids. What do you think of this? Oh, I've worked with this contractor. They're good. I didn't work with that. So it can be very formal. It can be very informal of how that evaluation process happens. My recommendation, as the project becomes higher dollar value, the more scrutiny you want to put into the evaluation process. And so, like, when my clients hire me for $30, $50, $100 million projects, I can base what my evaluation matrix looks like for them. Then notification of the award of project, you send out, hey, the five people that bid, thank you for your bid, you've not been selected, thank you for your bid, you will be our contractor, here's the contract to sign, and then you sign the formal contract. That's the process you go through on an RFP bidding situation. What happens, though, if there's an error? Remember we were talking about that $50 million project and somebody submits one that's for $42 million and the others are all right around $50, $51. And you kind of scratch your head and like, wow, why is that $42 million? Is that accurate? Is there an error? Can you give the contractor that may have made an error a second chance? There's laws about that. Again, on the private side, you can do whatever you want. You got to answer your board of directors if you have one, or if you have shareholders, if it's that type of public company. But in the private world, you have much more flexibility about errors and timing and everything else. So most of the rules on errors relate to governmental projects because you don't want to spend the money, the public's money. So bids that come in with an arithmetic or clerical error may be withdrawn, but they cannot modify. So if that $42 million was a bad digit in somebody's calculator, or somebody's form, and it should have been $47 million, they forgot a $5 million number. How they did it, I don't know, but these things happen. You'd be surprised. The only thing that $42 million contractor can do is say, I'm withdrawing my bid to never work on the project. They can't come in and say, no, we'll take it, but we'll do it for $47 million. The law says, if there's a clerical error, you can only withdraw. You cannot modify. So you're out of the project, or you have to do it for the $42 million. That's clerical error. Bids with judgment errors. Oh, wow. I didn't know that you actually were asking for us to dig that hole. That's going to cost another $3 million. Because everybody else had the $3 million hole dug in their bid. I didn't understand that from the drawing. I want to stick that $3 million into my bid. That's a judgment error. Not only can you not withdraw it, you can't add to it. So if you have $42 million as your bid and you forgot to include that $3 million worth of work, you're stuck. I can take that $42 million bid, you can't sign that contract for $42 million, and you have to figure out how to eat and figure out how to do that work for the $3 million. It's your error in judgment. That, of course, creates an adversarial relationship right out of the box. And that contractor is going to do everything they can to change order you to death to make that money back. That'll happen on the project. That's a reality of life. But in the bidding process, if the contractor made an error in judgment, they're stuck with it. The last thing, the exception to this error in judgment, it's what's called the snap-up rule. So the reason why I gave you this thing, the $42 million versus $50, and people are coming in at $50, $51, and everything else, there could be a $10 million swing, that's 20%. And if I, as the owner, know that there are no math errors in it, but I see, or maybe I don't see, but I suspect there may be an error in judgment in there, I'm like, let's get it. Let's take that $42 million. Let's lock them in. We're good. And that's their problem that they screwed up and they didn't understand it. We're going to take that. I snapped it up because I knew it was a benefit or windfall. The contractor may have the opportunity to show that the owner should have known that there was this gross deviation. The question is, what was that gross deviation? 20% seems like it would probably fall in that category. 10%? Definitely not. Certainly 5% wouldn't. So where does that snap up rule? Maybe 10%, maybe 12%. Where's that? It depends. And that would be the issue at trial. Did this owner, should an owner known that this was like so off? And so a contractor, especially with large projects, when they're awarded and they're like, oh my God, holy crap, I missed something, but the owner took advantage of me, they can, in very rare instances, and it's sometimes legally it costs more to get out on a snap-up rule than it would be to perform the work. So sometimes it's not even worth it, but you can, this rare exception to get out if you know the owner was taking advantage of it. And with public projects, by the way, all the bids are going to be published. So that contractor that bid 42 is going to see 50, 51, 54. They're going to know, they're going to be like, what happened here? The owner took advantage of me. So it's not like they have to guess of whether there was some kind of stamp out question.
So I understand the error
measure,
like a calculation.
Yeah.
Maybe they added something
wrong. Yeah, and you can see it in the form how they filled it out, because it's very detailed. These forms have got lots of numbers and everything else. Yes, so you understand that.
But I'm a little hazy on the judgment error.
Okay.
I thought it would only take 50 hours, but it's actually going to take 100 hours.
That's one type of error judgment. If it's how many hours they think to do it, that's your problem. You're the one that's estimating. The other is they get the series of drawings. That's why I use this example of how, like, a hole. Maybe they forgot that there's a whole piece of the foundation of a building that they didn't figure out that they needed to excavate that. When you start, and what can happen is you can actually start looking at when the contractor submits their bid and their proposal, they're going to actually, because it's not going to just be drawings or any specifications. You're going to see the detailed response the contractor's going to get, and you may figure out as the owner, or the contractor may eventually figure it out along the way, that I missed this in the drawings. I had a case where there was the contractor bid. It was for army barracks out in western part of Illinois, and there were three levels of a number of barracks. There were many, many barracks that they were converting, and there were three levels in each one. And they had to rip out all the floors. They had to redo the bathrooms. It was like, and it was, I think it was nine buildings, and there were three floors for each building. And then there was something that happened on the roof. And for like five of the buildings, they only bid two of the three floors. The first four, they did all three floors. But when they did, and it wasn't an arithmetic error, because there wasn't an incorrect math adding. They just didn't have the full scope in there. They forgot. They didn't understand. They were stuck doing the project because that was an error in judgment of how much work needed to be performed. What ended up happening in the project is they completely, like, shortchanged everything because the cost was going to be very prohibitive to the contractor. And so they shortchanged a lot of stuff. And then there was the project was done very poorly. The government was not very happy. So there was a lawsuit ensued. And actually, during the middle of the lawsuit that we were prosecuting on this case, the president of the general contracting company was indicted for bank fraud. So that's a totally different thing. So he had some problems anyway as an individual. But there was clearly an error in judgment of how they bid this project. And so they were not allowed to withdraw or had it come up. That one was never about withdrawing, but that was an issue where you could tell that they didn't put the numbers in. So that's what happened. And it wasn't a snap-up rule. That one was a situation where you couldn't tell if the numbers, because it was all over nine buildings, but when you finally got into it, you could see that these five buildings, they didn't build in the numbers properly. So the government wasn't in a situation where they were violating the snap-up rule. And I don't even know what the other bids were. That never was a question. But it was clear there was a bidding mistake. They just blew the bid. And that happens. And you're stuck with it as a contractor.
So does that usually happen with, you know how you said there's parts that, like, are going to have to specify, and then there's some parts that are, like, it's supposed to be common knowledge?
Right. Yeah. So if an architect You're never, as I said, I've said this many times, you're never going to put out a 100% complete set of drawings. There are things that contractors should understand, and I'll show you the provision in the A201 when we get there. It talks about that the contractor has reviewed the drawings and they understand how to build this building because they have knowledge, industry knowledge of constructability and what goes into it. And so it doesn't have to say every single thing. It doesn't have to say how this corner is terminated, how this and that. But if the contractor didn't include what was necessary for that, but it's the term is what's called, if it's reasonably inferable from the drawings and the specifications. So if a normal contractor can look at these drawings and say, I should have to do work A, B, and C, because I can reasonably infer that because I'm a sophisticated general contractor in this, I then as a contractor when I put my bid in, I'm responsible for A, B, and C because the standard is that I'd reasonably infer. But if I as a contractor submit a bid and I'm only giving costs for A and B, and I come back later and say, I didn't understand C. If four to five other contractors said, I understood C, then the first one that forgot it is stuck with that because four to five contractors surveyed said, we should do A, B, and C. So that's that kind of standard, that reasonable standard of what's reasonably inferable. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. Anything else on bidding? One question here.
At what point does this happen? Like, is it after
at what point does the bidding process happen? That's a great question. So we're going to get into the timing in a second, but I'll answer it for you right now. If you are doing the traditional, what we had the linear that I talked about in the very beginning, design, bid, build, the bidding happens when the drawings for the project are anywhere between 90 and 100% complete. All the way. All construction drawings with all arrows and numbers and dimensions and everything else. That's in a linear design, bid, build. If you're doing design bid, if you're doing fast tracking for different types of things, you may bid in packages. What may happen is the architect may send out a set of drawings for the foundations, and it may not be complete, but they'll know. Or for the electrical and plumbing, it's what's called one-line drawings. So you don't actually draw the plumbing line, you just draw a single line. That's where the plumbing's going to be. And the contractor, because they understand contracts and constructability, they may bid off of partial drawings. So you can have a bid come in at 30% complete of the design drawings, and that may be at design development and going into construction document phase, but then the contractor may say, if something dramatically changes, I get a change order. So I had a project where it was a $175 million hotel. They came in at, I think we were at, like between 50 and 60% of the design drawings were finished, and we sent it out for bid because we were on a fast track type situation. So it wasn't design build. We didn't have an architect and a contractor work together. The architect was working on the drawings and the contractors were separate. But when the architect was like 50, 60%, we sent the drawings out. Contractor bid came in at $175 million. We awarded to that contractor. I can build your 290 key room hotel for $175 million. As the drawings started to become more refined, the contractor said, oh, I inferred X from the 60% drawings. Now that we're at 80%, it looks like it's X plus Y. That's going to cost you another $5 million. I get a change order, and that was legitimate because the architect refined and they weren't sure. So there's a process, and so we went from 175 to 180. So there is a process to cover that, and that's in the contract. So the bidding can happen in all different phases. Traditionally, the traditional method is after the design fill are completed. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, it's over there. So if there's a judgment error, can the contractor submit a change order to make the difference? The technical answer is no. The reality is they will try to figure it out. There are contractors that are what's out there that are called claims contractors. The project comes in at $42 million, they're awarded the job, everybody knows it's $15 to $2 million, and literally like 3 weeks into the project you're going to get a claim letter, and then 6 weeks you're going to get a claim letter, and it's letter after letter after letter after letter after letter, and I've had projects like that. There are contractors that have a notorious reputation of being claims contractors, and so when the project's all done, they've submitted $15 million worth of change orders, of which they get 9, and they've gone from the $42 million bid to 51 or 52. They've made their profit on that. They knew they were going to do that. The owner ends up paying. It becomes very adversarial, but that happens. So can they? They shouldn't, because they bid and they shouldn't have to charge for more. Will they? Yes. They're going to figure out how to work it in. And it may not even be where that judgment area is. They may say something entirely different. Oh, These light switches are totally different than what I thought they were. So they're going to cost you whatever. I mean, actually, this is kind of amazing. I raised light switches. I had a factory that was put up. The way the architect specified it, why they did it, the box, the junction box, you guys know what a junction box is? Okay, this is a junction box right here. This is a junction box. Right here? On the project that I was in, $500 for every junction box in this thing. $500. Because they were all stainless steel. And they needed to be stainless steel in certain areas where there was wet things, but like literally throughout the entire project, $500 for every junction box. So like, price went through the roof and they made money off of that. That's what happens. So, anything else? Okay, moving on. Different type of contracting methods. I've talked a little bit about that. So we're going to talk about the traditional. All right. This is my triangle. I keep talking about it all the time. Here's a triangle. Owner, solid line to architect. Owner, solid line to contractor. No line between them. There is no there's no contract, no legal obligation between the owner and the contractor. That's your triangle. Now, there may be language in this contract between Oakland owner and architect that's mirrored in this language and vice versa. So there may be some things that says, architect may only do X. Remember we talked about the architect has only the authority to be the owner's agent when it specifically states. You're going to see similar language to that in the general contracting agreement that says architect is only owner's agent in the following circumstances. So we all know what the rules are. So you're going to have contractor rules in here, but it's only so this one understands what the contractor is going to do. And there's going to be architect rules in the contractor agreement only so the architect understands. No contract between. But down below each one, there's another series of contracts. You have subcontractor, subcontractor. Vendor is only going to be like a supplier of materials, a vendor. Or there can be some vendors that do just services, like maybe they'll kind of come in and do electrical, plumbing, or whatever. But these are your subcontractors. And you see over here, I don't have subcontractor. I have consultants. So this is what I've been talking about. This is your triangle with the umbrella. I call these the umbrella underneath. Everybody sits under the architect umbrella on the left side, and everybody sits under the contractor umbrella on the right side. Again, no, you don't see any horizontal lines between any of these entities because there is no contract. So for this graphic, solid line contract, nothing else, no contract, no legal obligations between them. Okay? That's a traditional method. Advantages, it's the common, it's the most common one out there. Everybody's comfortable with this process. That's how it does. It's easier. Lawyers understand it. Owners understand it. Architects understand it. Well, except for the one project I told you about at the beginning, but they all understand it. Plans for this model traditionally are complete prior to bidding. So that answers your question there. Normally you're at 95-100% for the plans. Architect remains independent. That's because there's no solid. So the architect sits on its side and they kind of help the owner out, but they're independent. They're not intermingling or commingling with the contractor's stuff. This type of model will work with lump sum, cost of work plus, and GMP. So the A102, A101, 102, and 103, it's going to work with all three of them. You'll see that. Disadvantage. The problem with this traditional design, bid, build and the triangle is during the design process, the contractor hasn't even been brought in. So the contractor may have ideas. God, I've built this 100 times. I can build it better, faster, cheaper, or let's say less expensive. We don't want to ever use cheap in the construction world, but I can do it better, faster, and less expensive than the way the architect's designing it. It's not to say the architect's wrong in the design, but I can give you some more input. Had I been involved during the design process, we could have maybe brought your price down. So you don't get that with that traditional design, bid, build method. Slower delivery, because it's just linear. I can't start constructing until I bid. I can't bid until I see the full drawing. So your process from beginning to end is slower with the design, bid, build. Can create an adversarial relationship between the general contractor and the architect. Because if we go back one slide, what you're going to see is the architect sitting over here, and if they have an issue with the contractor, they don't have to talk. They go to the owner and say, the contractor did a bad job. And the contractor's like, architect's drawings are terrible. And it creates this adversarial relationship that goes between them. Sometimes the owner has to be the middleman. Sometimes they don't. But that can be a problem when you have this traditional triangle in the design bid build concept. Price competition reduces profits and can render some projects unobtainable. So what does that mean? Well, if you're in a very highly competitive market and you have this traditional model where the architect and contractor aren't working with each other beforehand, you have these prices, then maybe you don't get as many bids. I've had projects that have gone out where the architect thought it was going to cost a certain price, and it turns out that all the contractors are much, much higher, and when you go back and try to get them to bid at what your budget is, you can't get anybody to do it. Then you got to go back to the architect or drawing board. You have to change a lot of things. So the price competition issues can be a problem. Claims contractors, that's what I just described when you asked the question of can they try to make up their money on their bidding errors. They'll do these claims contracts. They get the low bid, but is that really the true low bid? And then truth in bidding, when you have this design bid build, especially if you're dealing with lump sum where you're not seeing the actual numbers, is it really an accurate bid when you do this design bid build process? Okay. And truth in bidding comes into all projects, not just design bid build. It comes in any project. So you want to make sure that the contractor's accurately submitting a bid. Okay, next model. Developer as a prime. So what does this mean? So an owner, I want to go out and develop a subdivision. I bought this land and I'm going to hire a developer. I own the land. I'm not a contractor. I don't know anything about construction. I own land. So I'm going to hire a developer. And that developer is going to go out and hire the architect or the contractor. So this is a prime. So the contract, I don't have as the owner. I'm not in contract with the contractor, the architect. I'm in contract with the developer. And I say to the developer, you handle the triangle down below. So if something goes wrong with the design, the owner sues the developer, doesn't have to sue the architect. If something goes wrong with the construction, the owner sues the developer, doesn't have to deal with the contractor. The developer will sue these other entities because they say, hey, you were supposed to do your job. But the developer as a prime model is something that is one other project delivery method. This is going to be in a situation where the owner doesn't want to be in the day-to-day involvement with the project. It could be a single project. It could be, like I said, like a single building, or it could be like I said, a subdivision where they want to develop land and everything else. You're going to see this. There are many, many owners in the world where they just, like I've actually been approached by my clients where I have clients that are developers and they're like, hey, we're building a condo complex. Do you want to invest in this? Do you want to be a partial owner? I never do it because I just don't want to do that with my clients anyway. But I would be in this developer prime model where I was the owner and had nothing to do with the project, but once they started selling the condos, I would make money off of it. So this is a more of an economic model, but it's a model that's used frequently out in the industry. So, one other way that this could also come into situation a little bit different, and we'll talk about LLCs and corporate structures in another lecture, but you could have a company that's like Mike Hanahan Construction, Inc., and then I'm really a construction company. I build buildings and everything else, but for each single building, I set up an independent limited liability corporation, an LLC, and that would be then Large Building LLC. And so owner Mike Hanahan Construction Inc. enters into a contract with Large Building LLC, who then enters into these other contracts down below. And that's for, again, it's a legal way of insulating my giant company from the mistakes that may happen from Large Building LLC. Again, we'll have a different lecture on business corporations and stuff, so you can understand that a little bit. But that's one of the reasons why you would also do an owner-developer model. Fast-tracking model. So this can be applied in different variations, but it's the opposite of this design bid build model. So here's another graphic you can take a look at. Traditional model, and going to your question of when does the bid come in, you design, and like we're about like 95% here, then you bid on the pricing and you get the contract. The contract's awarded, you sign, and maybe they start digging a hole, and then the construction happens. So it's this linear process. Fast tracking says, I'm going to design, but while I'm designing, I'm going to send some stuff out for bidding. I'm going to, like, if I'm 20-30%, I've got my structural steel, I've got my foundations, I've got my long lead items of stuff that I have to, like, specialty windows or specialty materials or equipment. So I'm going to send that part out to bid, and the contractor's going to get awarded for that project. And they're going to maybe even bid on the entire thing as a general thing, and they're going to start construction earlier. So I as the designer, I'm not even 50% or maybe right around construction, around 50-60%, but I'm not even finished with the whole design, but I'm going to start digging a hole and start working on the project. And then you can have different bid packages go out, and then ultimately, if you look at the graph here, the construction's done months, maybe even years earlier than the traditional design bid build. So that's what's called a fast track model, how you can accelerate things. Traditional is linear, fast tracks overlap. The advantage is delivery of speed and the completed project. I get my candy factory or my toy factory up and running, and I start making money faster. That can happen. What's the disadvantage? Well, when you're bidding at a project and the drawings only are halfway done, can we get it right? And that's where the owner has to do their homework and working with the designer to make sure these contractors are sophisticated in the industry. They know what the project is. The more experienced the contractor is, the better chance that it has the ability to give an accurate bid, an accurate estimate of the project. But if you remember my example, we did a hotel. This was exactly what happened. They bid the hotel at $175 million at 50 or 60%. I can't remember where we were in design drawings. And then there were changes that came in because it was not reasonably inferable, and we got a $5 million change order. There was a number of them. I think the project ended up coming in just under $200 million, so there was like ultimately a $20-some million increase because of changes. Some were legit, some were like additions to the project, but some were, you weren't quite sure when that bid first came in. So that's one of the disadvantages of how you control costs and estimating. So I would say, well, I can tell you for sure the percentage, since I've been teaching this class, I think it's my 14th year, the percentage of fast track has increased, you know, maybe triple. Much, much more fast track. Owners are more sophisticated, contractors are more sophisticated, the estimating software is better, lots of things. So you'll see fast track a lot more now than you did, like I said, 10, 15 years ago, and I'm sure it'll only increase as you guys continue to work out there. Any questions on fast track? Yes, over there.
Do you do multiple bids, so one of them for foundation?
Yes, you would do multiple bids, but what you don't do, what you wouldn't do is to different contractors. So what happens is when you choose, you know, you're in a horse, they go to a company, I use the term as a horse race, you're getting down the short list. Eventually you're gonna choose your horse. You know, you're gonna put it down in secretariat, whoever it is, it's gonna run to the end of the finish. That's the finish line here. So you're gonna do that evaluation in this fast tracking at the beginning of when you, and you select a contractor. Just like you're gonna do an evaluation to choose your horse in the design bid build. Once you choose the horse, you're effectively stuck with it. So that could be another disadvantage. If you got a bad contractor and you made the wrong choice, you're stuck with them. And that happens over there too in the linear. But so these bid packages, though, you're exactly right, they do go out often in chunks. And so sometimes, and this didn't happen in the $175 million, but sometimes the bid package will come in and, you know, contractors are low to do this. But I've had, not that project, but I've had other projects where bid packages come in, and we actually have a deductive change order, and the $175 million will go down to $168 million. So you can actually reduce the GMP because the contractor thought, oh, I thought this was going to be more expensive. I included more money in it. My bid came in way under. Let's reduce the GMP. It's less common. I mean, what contractor wants to give up that security blanket? But it does happen. So, question. Is the fast track concept a similar project for the owner architect?
Does the owner go out to bid for the project, or like does he send out the project and then the architect?
So yes, that's a great question. Is there a bidding process? I think your question is there a bidding process or some type of process that the owner may use to choose an architect? The answer to that is yes. So I think I told you guys that we did, I worked on the Navy Pier project, in the Navy Pier, the horizontal renovation. They went out, that was actually a worldwide RFP. It was sent out and there were people that was all international. But the difference is between that process is they're not necessarily, I mean, there are prices that come in. They do bid on what they think that they're going to do. But it may be, here's my hourly rate. Sometimes you do have architects that bid on lump sums. That's going to be, though, a more subjective concept because you're going to look to see, I like the way this architect designs, but very much so, there are RFP processes. So I can say this, like as an example, my former firm, that I worked for. I did all the, not surprisingly, I did all the architectural and construction contracts for, we had offices in 16 or 17 different cities across the country. And so when we would do a renovation of an office, we'd go out. And most of the time I would do all the work for them, for the construction contract. But for our home office here in Chicago, when I was working for them, we wanted to do a brand new conference center. And it ended up being like a $3 million project. So it wasn't huge, but it wasn't small. And we went out and we interviewed 9 architects, or got proposed, like the initial pre-qualification of 9 architects. We narrowed it down to 4. Those 4 architects came in and actually did storyboards, they did presentations, we met the individuals that would be the lead designers, and then we selected one. So it was a similar process of how you choose an architect. And that's important. You want to make sure that you have the right feel, that they have the right style, that you trust them. When you spend any dollars with someone, you want to have a good relationship. So yes, that's an important process. So, okay, next model. This model is called multi-prime. Multi-prime is something I'm going to show you. I would never recommend it. This one looks very different. Now, there's no architect on here, so in a multi-prime, you're going to have like another part of the triangle. This is just what you're seeing up here is the left-hand side of the triangle. I'm sorry, the right-hand side of the triangle. In that, the owner, instead of entering into a contract with a general contractor, if you remember a couple slides before in that triangle, there's a middle piece between owner and all these people down here. It's called a general contractor. And the general contractor deals with all of these people down below. They go from subcontractors to called prime contractors, but this is the electrician. This is the foundation guy. This is the carpenter. This is somebody that supplies the doors. This is somebody that supplies the millwork. This is somebody that maybe gives advice on how to do soil samples or what have you. So what happens is the owner enters into all the contracts with everybody. This happens from time to time. The owner does a lot of projects. They build a lot of things. They're like, I've done this before. Why should I pay a 10% fee to the middleman? I can save my company 10%. And I can do it. I know I've got these really good people, and this happens. And most of the time, it happens when I get involved, and I've dealt with the client. They're like, "We've done 11 projects. They're all cookie cutter. We should just cut out the middleman." And I always tell them no, because what happens is, so here we go. There's no role for the general contractor. Contractor has all the contracts. Legally, you may want to try to do that, but the problem is, as much as the owner thinks that they can do this, they rarely are able to successfully manage and coordinate the project because the owner makes widgets. The owner makes candy. The owner, whatever it does, we've built 5 candy factories. We know how to do this. Well, that's because you're a candy factory company. You're not a construction firm, so you don't understand all these things. So almost every time, not every time, but many times when an owner gets into multi-prime, they get in trouble because they are not general contractors. The other problem here is if something goes wrong, the owner has no one to sue but themselves. I mean, yes, they could sue this prime contractor, but what happens if this prime contractor, the electrician, caused problems with the carpenter or vice versa? Well, they're going to be fighting back and forth with each other. The owner is sitting here. If it was just a general contractor, the owner would only have to go to the general contractor. You figure out your problems with your subs. I don't have to deal with that back and forth. So it's a model. It's called multi-prime. Don't recommend it. You may have owners, as the architect, come to you and say, "Oh, I love your drawings. They're wonderful. I've done this a bunch of times. Can I just go out and contract these all myself?" Tell them no. But it'll happen. It happens. So, okay, construction manager contracting models. So I talked about a construction manager for an owner on the outside, so there's a couple different models of what we do for that. Again, this is the right side of the triangle that we're looking at for this slide. So the owner here, this is a multi-prime concept here. Sometimes there may be a general contractor in here, but just for purposes here, even though it looks like a multi-prime. But what the owner has done in this instance is they've hired this entity called a construction manager as an agent. As an agent. Because they're the agent, the construction manager is speaking on behalf of the owner. And the construction manager's job will be to manage these trades. So it works kind of like a general contractor, because that's what the general contractor is. They manage everybody underneath their umbrella. But the construction manager doesn't have the agreement with all the parties. The owner does. So the owner may get some of the benefit of cutting out the middle person, but they're going to look and rely on their agents to help manage the project. That may be schedule, time, costs, those types of things. Okay? So the construction manager as an agent is retained to, shockingly, manage the construction. They do not enter into agreements directly with those trades. The owner does, or sometimes there's a general contractor. The construction manager and agent sometimes is referred to as an owner's representative. So, as an example, when we built our candy factory for Haribo up in Wisconsin, we hired, or Haribo hired, at my recommendation, an owner's rep. The construction manager is an agent. Haribo entered into a general contract with a general contractor. So, though different from this slide, there was actually that middle person. But the owner's rep, or the construction manager, is an agent. That entity back-checked. They looked at what the schedules were. They looked at whether there was warranties being applied. They looked at what the pricing was. They were the people that helped manage the project, because the people who worked at Haribo, and they, by the way, they have a couple people that actually are Haribo employees that are very sophisticated construction people. So they knew what they were doing. It was not an issue. Like they were just really knowledgeable about construction. But they still hired this outside entity to help them for the really nitty-gritty, and it saved them, I would say, millions. Because, not that the contractor took advantage, the contractor on the project was excellent. But some things happen, you need to clarify stuff. And so that was an owner's rep working for him. So very good, it's a good thing. I strongly recommend on any project that I have, I don't know if a $1 million project, but I know if you're getting to $5 or $10 million, I always say to my owner, hire an owner's rep, and every dollar you pay them, in the majority of these cases, you will save that much or more on the cost of the project. It's a benefit. And they also look over the architect's shoulder, too. I mean, it's a good thing. It's the owner's rep sits there and helps out the owner to make sure the project is done right. So they're on site sometimes they're not. They work similar to like an architect, but they don't do the design, but they're kind of there to protect the owner as an owner's rep.
Question? Contractors and
contractors. So the reason why I do that is because this slide I could have, if we go to the next page, you can see there's a construction manager at risk, which is the spot where a general contractor is. I could have done this slide. It would be two different ways. Sometimes I have a slide like this, or this graphic, where there's an owner and there's a general contractor in it. So a trade contractor is the electrician is the trade of being an electrical company, a carpenter. So I call it a trade because it's more just because I didn't put two graphics up. I've done this in the past. In the past I had one graphic that had the general, like I split these in half. I had the exact same graphic and there was a general contractor in the middle and then another graphic without the general contractor. So if the owner's directly in contract with the trade contractor, they would be a prime contractor. So you are correct in that observation. But the concept here is that these trades are going to be managed by, as far as schedule and timing and everything else, by the construction manager as an agent. The owner's not going to be doing that management. Okay? Construction manager at risk. So there's as an agent and at risk. Construction manager at risk is kind of like a general contractor. If you look at this, this looks like the triangle that we had. And so the construction manager at risk does assume lots of the responsibilities of like a general contractor. The difference is they're going to come in more in the fast-tracking model. A construction manager at risk typically will interface or interact with the architect during the design process. They'll help to try to make things better, faster, cheaper. They have more pre-construction services. But it works like a general contractor, because here, if you look at the way, if you remember, think about how the triangles, if it's a solid line, there's a contract. So the construction manager at risk assumes the risk of all these contractors. And you're right. This one says prime, and this one probably should say trade. So thank you for calling it out, because now I got to correct this. This says trade contractor here. And then they may have their subs underneath that. But When there's a problem with the construction, the owner only sues the construction manager at risk for all of the things that fall downstream from it there. So that's the difference. And what will happen in a CM at risk or construction manager at risk contract is at some point in time when the construction actually starts, they never call a general contractor, but that's actually what they're acting. They kind of convert from CM at risk to a general contractor because they're always carrying the risk. So they're going to work with the owner for pricing and securing subcontractors. So that's what a general contractor does too, but they're going to do it earlier. After the CM is executed, the construction manager eventually will assume more of a general contractor role. Like I said, once the project is up and running, they're going to be more like a general contractor. And they're liable for the management and coordination of the problems during construction. That's like a general contractor. But most of the time, the biggest difference between this model and just a straight general contracting model is that this will happen. The construction manager will become involved earlier in the project while the design is going on. So if we go back, I'll go back a few slides to the fast track slide. In this model that you're looking at fast track, and the bids are coming in here, this more likely is going to be a CM at risk contract because it's earlier in the process. And then as the construction starts going, they're going to be coming more like a general contractor. So you're going to see, this will see a traditional general contractor structure. This will see a CM at risk type structure. It's a nuance, very limited, very narrow, but there is a difference between the two of their responsibilities. I would say that the CM at risk has more responsibilities than just a straight general contractor is the best way to think about it. So, how does the spectrum work? I don't even have a slide for advisory CM. Advisor construction manager is somebody that kind of, in the beginning, that's not the architect, but that somebody you might meet that gives you some ideas and consulting about how the project can go. And you can hire an agent. A construction manager is an agent. That was that first slide, like I said, that we use for Haribol. You can hire them even before the project to kind of give you advice on how the project should be put together and structured. What architects should we bring in? What contractors should we bring in? So there's an advisory CM, and then a little more risk, the agency CM. So in an agency CM or construction manager and agent, if there's something that goes wrong with the schedule, and that CM, the construction manager and agent was responsible for schedule, then they may have some risk for that. So it's moderate. And they get paid for a fee. They get paid on a fee. And then CM at risk is the highest risk to the contractor. And as I said, it's ultimately they're going to be like a general contractor. So any questions on that? Design build. So then another type of model that we're going to use here and how the project goes. This one, basic simple design build. It is not a triangle. It's just a one-to-one relationship. I, as the owner, hire this entity to design and construct my project. One-stop shop. It's going to be fast track. You're going to have the contractor portion of this design build entity be building while the architect's designing. The architect's drawings don't have to be nearly as complete, because they're working with the contractor. They can have conversations, you know, and everything else. They obviously have to be complete enough to get a building permit, so there has to be certain requirements, but not near the level of detail that you're going to see in a traditional or even a fast-track method when the designer and the contractor are separate. Design-build is a very good model. It's faster, less expensive, but there can be risks because the drawings may not be as efficient or otherwise. There can also be a risk that you chose the design builder and then you're stuck with them because you can't get rid of one or the other. You have to keep them through the whole thing. So, it's an integrated company. The contract, and they do it different times. There are different ways. You can have the contractor as a prime. By the way, a lot of design build entities can be for single projects. Architecture firm, contractor have worked together. Oh, for this project, let's go together and make a single-purpose limited liability company, and we'll bid it as a design build. We're going to have a relationship, not for all our projects, but for some projects. Or you can have companies that say, we've worked with this architect together, we worked with this contractor together, we're going to become one company forever, we're always going to do design build work. So sometimes the contractor is the prime, meaning they're the ones that kind of lead the charge, and they take on the risk, and they hire an architect or an engineer as a sub. Sometimes the AE is the prime. The architect engineer is the prime, and they hire a contractor to be a sub, but they're both doing design build. Sometimes the AE is the prime and they hire, instead of one contractor, they do the multiple contractors. That's kind of like that example that I talked about earlier today where the architect assumed all these contracting responsibilities. They hired a bunch of prime subs underneath them. Shouldn't have done it because they weren't sophisticated in it and they didn't do their job, but that's a different concept. Sometimes you have a design builder as this prime entity, so it's this company that sits up above, but they have then different engineers and contractors underneath. So they have this, it's a multiple integrated company. You don't have to worry about this for the exam, this one, but it becomes very complex when you have very sophisticated type facilities and you're doing design build. And then the joint venture concept is you have two different companies, as I said. You have an architect and you have a contractor, and then for a single project they come together and they create this like temporary company to do them together under a joint venture. So that's how they may come together for your traditional one-stop design build. Here's an example, just a breakdown of this multiple integrated company. The owner enters into a contract with a design builder, but the design builder entity, whatever that legal entity might be, has a design affiliate and a construction affiliate. They may be separate, working on different things, but they have this one design builder. Sometimes you also see it like there are some construction companies that their primary job is to be a construction company, but they have a division for specialty types of water projects. We do design build, and so you can enter into the contract with the design build division, and they have their specialty people underneath. So sometimes it's just how the company operates. Here's another multiple integrated company model where the owner actually has, it's design build. Like I said, the construction affiliate and the design affiliate come together, and then the owner enters into it. But you may have a contract that mentions both. Like I had a power plant contract up in Wisconsin. There was a construction company joint ventured with the engineering firm, and the contract said owner is entering into this contract with construction company and engineering firm as a joint venture. So they both were on the contract. They both knew they were there. So that was the model that's being used here. They both had equal responsibility for each other too. So if the contractor screwed up, you could go after the engineering company even though they didn't do any of the work because they were jointly combined for that. What are the advantages of design build? Speed of project delivery, because you don't have to do this linear thing. The owner can look to the design builder for single point responsibility. I just go to one entity. I don't have to fight between contractor and architect as whose fault. You guys are both at fault. Or you both are doing a great job, whatever that might be. You can obtain cost certainty earlier with better results because the contractor doesn't have to say, and thankfully can't say, I don't understand the drawings. So when they bid a price, it's because they're communicating, the contractor and the architect are communicating all along the way, so you get better price certainty. And that's, like I said, the next one, better communication from design intent to constructing. Less litigation or disputes. I mean, probably yes, because you don't have the fights between architect saying, contractor did a bad job, contractor saying, architect drawings are bad. You don't have that infighting. So you have less litigation. Greater control of information because it's all internalized. You still can have negotiated pricing, so that's good. You can go out and bid with various parties and get negotiated pricing. Probably one of the best things is the general contractor and the architect engineer are not at odds with each other. Those are good advantages. Disadvantages. You lose this independent architect that's looking over your shoulder. One of the things that the contracts say, if you remember from last week, is the architect can act as the initial decision maker. They can step in and try to get things that help keep good things or help keep squabbles between the owner and the contractor or between contractor and architect. They can step in. So you lose that independence that's protecting them. Pricing may be suspect, because you don't have anybody, again, looking over the contractor's shoulders. Like, you know, your architect, remember, is you had a budget. And the architect's designing to that budget and giving you estimates. It's going to be $48 million. It's going to be $49 million. It's going to be right under your budget of $50 million. You don't get any of that feedback because the architect and the contractor are together. And so when the bids come in at $53 million, even though you kept saying $50 million, $50 million is my budget, and they all come in, and the bid from these design builders come in at $53 million, no one was there to manage that, to be your check and balance. So that's a disadvantage. Maybe more of an economic risk. Maybe the contractor that the architect paired up with wasn't as sophisticated, or maybe the architect that the contractor paired up with didn't have the design chops. So there could be risks of cost depending on the experience and sophistication between the two entities. If we have this joint venture that goes in where the contractor and the architect have never worked together before, maybe there's going to be squabbles internally because they only joined up at that last minute, so you don't have a continuity. So there's going to be cost risks. And then the last one, who's back-checking for the owner? The architect would back-check for the owner over the contractor, but now there's nobody doing that. If you're going to do design-build, that's when you want to bring in an owner's rep, a construction manager as an agent. They will do the back-checking, but the pure model doesn't do that. So, what are the differences that happen in the design phase services when you're doing design-build? So, this concept here, I have what system by system with looping feedback. Like, what does that mean? Well, when you're designing a building, you're going to be what's often referred to in the industry as you're designing systems. I have my foundational system. I have my electrical system. I have my framing system. So that's how things are going to go out. They're, as you design, the concept is turned, or the work is often referred to as a system. Okay? So, as you, and depending on the project, they may be designed semi-independently. Like, if I do my framing of a house and how I'm going to frame it, yes, I know where my layouts are everything going to go, but I then later come back and put in where my ductwork's going to be for my HVAC or my electrical. So they're done in, well, necessary phases, but they are done independently. And what you want to do with the design build that helps things is you have the design team talking with the constructor, the contracting team. And they're going to say, oh, well, if you frame it this way, here's how we're going to have to build to put in the electrical conduit or the HVAC or the plumbing. And so you have this feedback. So if it's the traditional model, the architect's like designing and a system and a design a system and a design a system, and they may not interface as well as you want. With design build, the contractor's there to say, this is how I would build it. This is how these systems would go together out in the real world. So that's this looping feedback concept. You get to have a communication in the design build process that doesn't happen with where the architect is separate from the contractor. And that's good. Informal communication rather than defensive detailing. If you are in the traditional model where the architect's sitting on one side and the contractor's sitting on the other side, you may put in more details into that drawing to make sure nothing goes wrong. They may be necessary, they may not be, but it's kind of like defensive detailing. You want to overcompensate to make sure that the project doesn't have a problem later. If you're in a design build, you're communicating, and you're going to be talking, and so you don't have to put as much detail in the drawings, so the drawings are completed faster. The project has started to be built faster. And if there's questions, they talk about it necessarily. Now, that has its own risks, obviously, because if the drawings are too light on the detailing, and you don't have a sophisticated contractor, then the work is going to be done poorly. I have another project that I was working on where a structure was designed as an outdoor-type structure. It then became converted to partially indoor structure. They never really updated the drawings, and they didn't have good communication with the contractor, and then it was built wrong, and it had problems where it leaked, and it had problems with structural issues and everything else because they were two separate entities. But had it been design-built, maybe we wouldn't have those problems. Greater incentive to explore alternate design concepts. Architects, not as a negative, but they, like, this is how I design things. This is how I design things. Contractors are like, I can build it differently. And so you have this relationship where you communicate and you say, oh, I like the way this design is, but maybe we can do it a little differently. Maybe we can do that truss system differently. Maybe we can do that electrical system differently, and we have that communication. So you get different design concepts, which can kind of come out cool in the actual end design work of what the aesthetic is versus the construction part. And then, like I said, MEP, which is mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and FP, fire protection, that's what these initials stand for, are only going to be schematic. So you're just going to have a line of where an electrical piece is going to go. They're called one-line drawings. And so you can keep things very, very high level. And that's faster and less expensive on cost to prepare the drawings and so forth. Any questions on that? A couple more things. Greater than usual pricing constraints and price inputs, meaning because the contractor's been involved in the design process the whole way, they will understand the cost to build this better than maybe a contractor just looking at the drawings from scratch and never having seen them before. Out-of-sequence provisions of design details to meet the contractor's need for the price of the project. Maybe the contractor says, I need this package and this package and this package. Get those to me now so I can price them. And I can do that in a different sequence than you may, as a separate architect, may have provided me the drawings. So you can, these systems, like I had a project a few years ago, back when we were coming, in 21 we were coming, we were still in COVID, can't remember the vaccine, maybe it just started coming out, but there was all the supply chain issues. And for the summer of 21, the price of lumber, plus there was astronomical amount of work going on in China. The price of lumber in the world rose anywhere between 150 to 300%. And so a 2x4 out of lumber was sometimes between 2 and 3 times more expensive than a steel stud. Same size, same structure that you'd be using. Steel studs traditionally a little bit more expensive, not a lot, and you want to use that in certain areas, whatever. But we had issues with the price, and my contractor on the project was saying to the architect, Give me the design so I can go out and price these materials. And they're like, I know you're not at ready at framing, but if you can give me those systems of whatever, I can go out and purchase these things at a cheaper price because of what's going on with supply chain issues. So that can happen better with design build. And then there's reliance on performance specs. I won't get into that detail that much, but that's another advantage. So, any questions on that? Good. All right, I'm going to show you a couple of test questions, and we can talk about how they look. Why can't I find this? Here, let's do this. That's not up. How do we get this over to the other screen? Let's do this. Let's see if this works. There it is. Okay, here are two questions from a previous exam that is kind of the way my exam... Not all my questions are going to be like this. Some are going to be true-false, but and some of them will, like, the first one's a little bit more, but there's a lot of words up there. That's why the exam will probably, not for everybody, but the majority, like, we have, 2 hours and 45 minutes or whatever our class time is. It'll take, I don't think anybody's gotten the exam done in less than 2 hours. Because it's just a lot of words. I talk a lot. You guys notice that. I write a lot. So there's a lot of words in the exam. The other thing is just take your time. I've never said to anybody, like, oh my God, it's 2 hours and 45 minutes to attend your exam. You'll have time to finish it and everything else. So that won't be an issue. And if you have to go a little bit longer, that's fine with me too. So that's the first thing you want to think about. I can actually turn off my lecture too. Hold on.